Welcome to the Dear Lovejoy podcast, sponsored by Quirker, spelt Quirker, pronounced Quirker. 100 degree boiling hot water directly to your kitchen tap. Today is a revisit special. We're going to revisit a podcast from yesteryear. Today is one of my favourite podcasts we ever did, actually. It was when I had a conversation with Megan Hine. And it was interesting because it was one of the first ones we did. I'd read the book. I'd seen an interview with her and I'd read the book, and the book made such an impact on my life. I sort of pleaded with her to come and to the house, and we did it. Do you remember we did it on a Saturday? And I was a bit nervous about the whole thing because I sort of...
It was the first ones we'd really chased
yeah.
someone to be on the podcast.
And we were quite shocked they wanted to do it.
Yeah. I mean, we always are, to be honest.
Do you remember, because I thought, oh, it's a Saturday. She's coming on a Saturday. And I thought, you know, I better line out a load of food. Do you remember? So I got a load of berries in. Do you remember this?
Croissants
and all that, just in case she
was hungry. Really nice cakes.
Yeah, I got all that stuff in just in case. She didn't eat any of it, I don't think. I think she might have had a cup of tea or something. But yeah, and we sat down and I thoroughly enjoyed her company. I think she thought I was a bit of a stalker. Because
yeah, definitely. That's the vibe you gave off.
I was such a big fan of hers. And the reason being is that I've said this a few times, but when you read these self-help books, by the way, Megan Hine's book is called Mind of a Survivor, and she is a survival expert. So she talks about going into jungles and up mountains and how to survive. And she puts all her theories on how to survive out there into a self-help book. Problem when you read self-help books is you take in all the information, you go, that's it, right? The new Tim Lovejoy is going to be amazing. I'm going to be out there. And I've got a positive attitude. I'm going to be a winner. I'm going to set goals or whatever crap I come up with after reading all these books. And then you forget it all within a week.
Yeah.
And my new theory is every time you read a book, just find one bit. Like, enjoy them, but just take one bit. And with her book, I really did take one bit, which was acceptance. And we discussed it on this podcast, but it just literally changed my life. Because if you don't have acceptance up a mountain or in a jungle, you die. And you take that stuff into your normal life. Yeah. She explains it all on the podcast. And it's made, and it literally is one of the biggest changes of my life, and has really helped me out massively. Did you enjoy the podcast?
I loved it. Yeah. I thought she was great. Actually,
I've recommended this book to many people, and I've given it to loads of people
as gifts, haven't you? Yeah,
and I've given it to people. I give it to Rocket Ronnie O'Sullivan, didn't I?
You gave it on the podcast. That's cool.
He never did get back to me and tell me what he thought about it. Do you reckon he read it? Maybe I'll tweet him and find out, or text him. Anyway, this is it. Revisiting Megan Hine.
This is just a guide to modern life. Modern life is hard to get just right. It can frustrate you and annoy. And if it does, write into Dear Lovejoy.
Welcome to my kitchen, Megan Hine. Thank you very much for coming down here.
Thank you for having me.
First thing I want to do is I want to give you a bottle of wine, because we've decided that it'd be nice to give you a guest. But Mark said that's such a rubbish idea to give Megan, because she probably won't drink. Do you drink?
I do, yes.
Oh, yeah, there you go.
Yeah, I do, yeah. Thank you.
Well, the man in the shop told me it's a nice bottle of red, so there you go.
That's brilliant. Thank you very much.
So obviously you don't drink when you're up a mountain.
Not normally. Not when I'm looking after other people.
Okay. Your book has had a major impact on me. It's one of those things that I picked it up and read it, and I always bang on to Mark about the fact that we are still nature, and he laughs at me. But whenever we're talking about the problems on this, I go, we're nature, we're still nature. And in essence, I think that's what your book's about, isn't it?
It is, yeah. It's very much about reconnecting with nature, which I truly believe is our natural habitat. Yeah, I really don't believe that we've evolved to live as we do now in this modern world. There are things missing from our lives. And I know sort of more recently there's been a sort of a rise in sort of mental health issues, things like stress and anxiety and depression. And I think a lot of that is just the way that we live at the moment. There are so many stresses that impact us every day. Whereas when you go back to nature, it's so much simpler. It's all about survival.
So I read an article about you, and because I like getting people on this podcast who inspire us and have something to say, I ordered your book and I picked it up. And just from the first page, I'm going to read the first paragraph of your book. I was like, wow. And I just read it for 2 days. This is the first bit. There's a popular rule of three you'll hear if ever you go on a survival course: 3 minutes without air, 3 days without water, 3 weeks without food. I'd like to add another 3 seconds without thinking. There you go. And then you say, because nothing will kill you quicker in the wilderness than switching off and making a bad decision. Now, you take that theory and you take it through into our modern life, which is the thing which really got me. It was the simplicity of it all, in a nice way, that I really liked. So the book is a self-help book, really, isn't it? But with lots of stories about your adventures.
Yeah, so the idea was triggered really by a couple of questions. So from a very young age, I used to read the typical sort of explorer books, Shackleton, Oates, Hillary and Tenzing, all these amazing books. And I remember just being so fascinated by them and the physicality of, the hardships that these explorers was enduring. So it went without saying, they were sort of very cleverly worded within these books. But the thing that was missing, and even as a child I recognised this, was the fact that they very rarely talked about their emotions and how they overcame, quite extreme situations that would break a lot of people. But they very rarely talked about how they overcame those things and how they dealt with those emotions. And then through my own experiences of guiding other people, and through my own experiences of being dropped into wilderness situations where you have to think really fast on your feet, I've realised that actually what I do is I separate out my emotions and I have to put them in a box. So that I can get on and do, what needs to be doing at the moment. If I'm dealing with, for example, a road traffic accident, you can't have those overwhelming emotions. You can't let, the horrendous things that you might be seeing get in the way. I think people like paramedics, A&E doctors must do the same sort of thing. And they're faced with pretty horrendous sort of extremes of suffering. You have to be able to do something with those emotions so that you can actually focus on the here and now. And it was like, well, actually, those things, can you take the ways of those coping mechanisms into everyday life?
So what made you write it?
Well, I was actually really fortunate in that I'd done an interview for, I think it was the Guardian newspaper. And off the back of that, I had several literary agents get in touch.
All right. Well, it's good. I mean, because the two bits which stick out, I've read a lot of self-help books and I read a lot of books for this podcast. Two bits which stick out are acceptance and responsibility. Can you explain acceptance in survival? Because it's a big bit of the book, isn't it, really?
Yeah, so acceptance to me is not accepting something to then give up on it. For me, acceptance is all about accepting the situation you're in. Because once you accept something, the world opens up, the sort of blinkers are removed. I mean, for example, if you were trying to fight your way through a door, this locked door, you're hammering on it and you can't get through it, but you're so focused on it that it's all about getting through that door. But actually, once you accept, okay, I can't get through this door, and you step back, and suddenly, the blinkers are off, and you actually see there's a window next to the door that you can actually climb in through.
The bit that I like, though, was that, and I'm not, the idea that you're out in the wilderness, you're out in nature, up a mountain, or you're in a jungle, and you injure yourself. If you don't accept that quickly, you're going to die.
Yes.
Which is basically your book, which is what I loved so much because it summed it up so much. So if something horrible happens to you, you accept it, you move on. Now, we've created this ridiculous human world where nature doesn't really exist anymore. And so the other day I got stopped for doing a little bit of speeding on my Vespa. I was only going a little bit over there. But your book came into my mind immediately because it's like, it's happened, accept it and move on, rather than go, I'm a victim, I'm not really, and I thought that was the beauty, because it's true, in nature you die. If you get injured and you sit there thinking you're a victim, nature will kill you.
It's true, and I think, when you're out in nature, if you're in that sort of survival situation, often you're on your own. Yeah, I think the way society is now, it's almost like we're bubble wrapping people, and people are more willing to, or more able to play the victim, and with their... because they accept it, or they expect that somebody's going to come and rescue them and sort them out. So, it's everybody else's fault but your own. But once if you keep fighting that, you're never going to move forwards.
Yeah, you talk about being a victim, don't you? And you're sitting there thinking, I'm a victim here. And it's like, it is what it is. Get on with it.
Yes, the victim mentality is can totally destroy you.
Well, I suffer from it, I think. I think we all do. But your book made me realise that. Sorry, I'm being so gushing here, but it's really, because it's that thing of you've got to accept it, otherwise you're going to die, and that's normal life. But how did you get into this stuff in the first place? Can I just explain, because I don't think I've explained enough. What is your job? What's your job title? A survival expert?
Yeah, so I have several different titles. I mean, so what I do, I split my time at the moment between leading private expeditions, which is, I've kind of got to a stage now where people will call me up and say, where would you like to go? We want to do something really cool. What do you suggest? And I have to kind of pinch myself because it's like, wow, I'm getting to go to these incredible places with these amazing people. And the other half of what I do is working behind the scenes on TV shows. So I will get sent out into a country to look for locations. I'll have spoken to a producer and I'll know sort of the format of the show and what they're looking for. And I'll go out and I'll look for these things. I'll look for, you know, big stunts or challenges and the survival element as well. So talk to maybe native peoples or local peoples to find out what they do hunting wise or fishing techniques, survival techniques, and pull it together into a journey.
And you work on with Bear Grylls on his TV stuff.
I do, yeah. I've been working with Bear for the past 10 years.
What's he like?
He's amazing. Like, he is so inspirational. He's just an incredible person to be part of the team.
Is he as good as you at survival?
Well, I mean, I've been working with him now for like 10 years, and everybody brings something to the team. Yeah, I mean, like, if you're...
You're not saying yes there, Megan. so yeah, I like him. I've interviewed him. He's really nice, isn't he?
Yeah.
What he brings as well to it is he's got a lot of charisma.
Yeah, it's the enthusiasm and it's infectious. And I mean, he is just, as a presenter, he's a phenomenal presenter and he will drive the show. So his energy like carries the show. I mean, we don't hang around. There's no second takes.
No.
Everything's done in one take.
And how dangerous is it? Well, because you put celebrities on these shows sometimes. How dangerous is it for the celebrities?
Well, I mean, we play with the perception of risk. So it's all about that. I mean, from the very nature of the terrain that we work in, you cannot remove the inherent risk. You know, we are going to dangerous places. But part of my job is on the safety, is to actually go out there, you know, and make sure that it's as safe as we can make it for the celebrities that come in. Yeah, so it's actually the most dangerous bit. It's often like running around on like really steep terrain, whereas the viewer and the celebrity themselves would actually think that the most dangerous part is when we're doing the rope stunts and things. But actually, once they're attached to a rope, I can actually breathe a sigh of relief because it's very, very unlikely that the ropes will fail on them.
It's funny because I get asked to do these shows sometimes and I'd love to do them. I've got a job, so generally I can't do it because I work a lot. But when you said in your book that it was really dangerous and you could actually die of being a celebrity doing it, you're saying you're minimizing the risk, but there's, because it's nature and the nature of nature, that you could, there's always something that could happen. It suddenly made me more excited to do it.
Really?
Because it's that element of, you know, when you watch a show and you think that crocodile's got its mouth wired shut, so there's no way it's going to bite you. You know, when you know that as a, I'm not sure how the situation, you say it's the perception.
I've never seen one wired shut. Their mouths are very free moving.
I don't they do that on not on your shows.
Maybe I'm a celebrity.
Yeah, I'm a celebrity. Don't they?
Yeah.
Why are their mouths shut? And I'm a celebrity. By the way, I don't know this. Don't sue me. They might. But they're. Let's move on from that, just in case I get myself in trouble. So, how did you get into it in the first place, then?
It was through family holidays initially. Both my parents were really into the outdoors. They both came like. Worked really, really hard to put themselves sort of through a career in academia. And as the oldest one of four, I think they assumed that I was going to follow in their footsteps. So I was very much pushed into sort of the academic life. I didn't realise that there was anything outside of that. But I discovered mountain biking quite early on. I was drawn into the mountains. All our family holidays were out into the mountains. And I just found myself just obsessed with it. And within four walls, I found myself getting quite stressed. I couldn't sit still. I'd have this like bubble of panic inside my chest that would rise if I was sat inside for too long. I needed to be moving. And with mountain biking and then the mountains, I really found myself. And I was able to push myself physically and mentally, and exploring those boundaries was just something that was, it was an incredible feeling.
I always find when I take my daughters, I've got twin daughters who are 15 and a younger one who's four, whenever I take them out into the park or into the woods or anywhere like that, their whole attitude and demeanor changes, their excitement, and they just feel relaxed. They don't see it and they're always going, oh, I don't want to go. But as soon as we get out there, they just seem to have fun and they smile and they do it. But they can't see it. Why? We go back to it. We have moved so far away from nature. Why have we, do you think?
I think it's a human thing, isn't it? The grass is always greener and there's, you know, we as a species, you know, are constantly trying to develop ourselves and better ourselves and sort of further ourselves. And, you know, technology, all these incredible things that we've achieved, when you think about what humans like I've actually achieved. It is phenomenal, considering, you know, our biology and like we're just a load of cells. Like, it is incredible. But yeah, we haven't been living out of caves really that long when you sort of think about it. It's like evolution takes, you know, hundreds of thousands, millions of years to occur. Like, how can we have actually evolved to live as we do now? It's like there's something missing. And I really think nature, there's room in nature for creativity, there's room for initiative, and intuition comes into that as well. All these things that actually make up resilience and actually make us who we are as humans.
And you notice when you have, when you put on expeditions and stuff, and you take out people, families or whatever, you notice that certain skills are being lost, don't you? And things like our motor neuron skills and things like that. You mentioned in your book that we're not actually very good at that anymore. Is that right?
Yeah, it's quite scary. I mean, it's a generalization, but I've seen it particularly over the past 5 years, like when I've been working with younger people in particular, that the motor coordination is being lost. And you know, this is, you know, if you're walking through the mountains, you know, most of us would sort of take it for granted that you can pick the easiest line as you're walking down a rocky path. But some of these children just cannot do it. You know, they can't coordinate their bodies enough to walk over rocky terrain. And it's quite dangerous because it means that, you know, there's no perception of risk or what's dangerous. And I'm sure that's down partly to how we live now in the fact that they spend a lot of time inside. You know, maybe they're playing computer games. And they're not actually getting outside and playing and developing those skills. You know, when you climb trees as a kid and you'd fall out of them, you'd run and you'd trip over and you'd pick yourself up. But if kids aren't allowed to do that, how can they develop those skills?
Yeah, and the ability to think for themselves is something you mention as well in the book.
Yes, yeah, and that for me, I find that quite concerning, really, if the generations don't get out and play and understand risk and, you know, understand the consequences of their actions, which is something nature teaches, like how, you know, when they come into sort of work and their children and things, we're just creating, humanity is going to lose their ability to understand risk, which puts us in a dangerous position, you know, as a society, when you've got other cultures maybe that haven't lost that.
Yeah, we had Will Storr on recently, and he was discussing about our self-obsession that we've created for ourselves in our society. And we've created this false world. There's lots of ways to fail. I've gone through some really dark times, and if you are going through depression, you're listening to this, just get yourself out in nature, because there's no human man-made rules there. This basically nature's rules. Just for a walk in the park or in the woods actually makes you feel a lot better. And I also think that what people don't understand, and through reading your book, you really get a sense of it. Nature's a really good stimulant, isn't it?
It is, yes. Yeah, it really is. And I think, I mean, you hit nail on the head there about going out and just going for a walk or going sitting in the park. I think there's a push at the moment. This has become quite fashionable and people want to become an adventurer. Again, I think that's, you know, it's answering a call that's missing. But it then starts making people feel guilty for not getting out and doing these crazy adventures, whereas actually what I'm trying to achieve in my book, yes, I compare it to, you know, some of the crazy things that have happened to me out in the wilderness, but it's very much about encouraging people just to get out into nature. You know, in your lunch break, go out and sit in the park, just go for a walk, go with the dog, go with the kids, and go and spend time in nature. It's not about having these epic adventures.
Yeah, well, so I had this argument with Mark not so long ago on this podcast, where I say man-made tourist attractions are just ridiculous, they're awful, get yourself out in nature, it's much more fun. And he was going, and he was saying, no, they're not, and people are going, no, they're not, but Disney World and stuff is useless. You queue for hours for no reason, or Eiffel Tower or something. You queue, all of them. It's just not, you pay money and queue. You go to nature, you have fun, boof, like that. Economics are fun. It happens immediately. But your book, what it did is it made me excited about the planet. It also made me feel like a rubbish human being, because I don't think I'd survive a day out there. That's the problem. We're so far away, removed from it, that you need so many skills and we're not taught them anymore. We wouldn't survive a day, would we?
I think that's the issue. If you think that you're not going to survive, then chances are you probably won't.
Right.
Yeah. It's all about, you know, it's not, I think survivors don't even question that. When I looked into sort of what is resilience and what makes a survivor, you know, those that survived, you know, are often those that society wouldn't expect to. You know, children, you know, stay-at-home mothers, you know, that have ended up in these situations who's like stereotypically, you know, wouldn't be considered as survivalists. But, you know, they've gone out there and they haven't given up. You know, it's not even like a decision. It's just like, it's not even an option to give up. They just keep going and going. And you don't know how you're going to react until you're in that situation. And that's what I always tell people when people are like, oh, I could, you know, I'm faced with some sort of life or death situation. And people are like, oh, I'd never have survived that. But you don't know you wouldn't until you're actually out there. You know, how often in everyday life are you actually confronted with a life or death situation? You know, it's only when you're at those extremes that you realize like how strong you actually are. And I think that's where, you know, the stories of from the extremes actually come into everyday life. Because once when you're out in nature, you know, if you're pushing your limits and you're confronted with, you know, like a few weeks ago, I was out in Kenya and got caught in the crossfire between a couple of tribes and some local rangers, you know, in that situation, like you can't afford to lose your head. Like you have to keep your shit together. You have to keep it together. There's no other option.
Tell us about that incident. What happened?
So I was out there with actually with my partner. And another guy, and we were rigging a challenge. We had a. Yeah,
by the way, your partner Stanny. You talk about him in the book. He's still he's a survival expert as well, isn't he?
Yes, yeah, we're very lucky we get to work together a lot. But we were out. We were rigging a stunt across a gorge, and there's a river running through the bottom of this gorge, and there's actually man-eating crocodiles in there. As a couple of days ago, a couple of the locals had actually been eaten. So I was on one side, I'd been rigging on one side and the guys had been rigging on the other. And I just finished off what I was doing. I was taking photos of the rigging so that when we came in to film the next day, I could rig really quickly. And suddenly it was like something out of a Hollywood movie, like the sand just exploded next to me and this sort of volley of gunfire went off, around me. So I like dived into this little alcove, and was sat in there for a few minutes, with these sort of rounds going off. And then I realized that the fire was coming towards me, and the best thing for me to do was to actually get over to the other side where the guys were, where they were actually inside a cave. So I legged it down, like kind of slid down the cliffs into the river at the bottom, like legging it through the river, please don't eat me, up the other side, and up into the cave where the guys were waiting. And we spent about 15 minutes in there with the rounds ricocheting off the roof of the cave before we could get out of there. And what happened was that we were out there when the sort of the really bad droughts were happening, and the humans and animals were being drawn to the water courses there.
Right.
And the one tribe had stolen like hundreds of goats from another tribe. And this tribe had obviously gone after them to get them back. And the rangers, local rangers, had laid an ambush directly above where we were working in this gorge. And it had all just kicked off just above where we were.
Wow.
Yeah.
I really haven't done the book justice yet, actually, by the way, because it is it's a fantastic self-help book, but it's also an amazing adventure book as well. There's so many exciting things which happen in there to you. And it's also a book about sort of like, in a way, sort of... Indiana Jones book type thing, all your little adventures you have, but also the way that you survive things as well, and little tips of how to survive. But the danger element of it is huge. And after reading the book, I started noticing that a lot of people die in nature all the time. And even recently, that British climber Andrew Foster, even a couple of days ago, was crushed to death. He was in Yosemite National Park. Did you hear about him?
Yeah, I did, yeah.
He was a climber, and, you know, I think he's an experienced climber, wasn't he?
Yeah.
And then just so happened that some rocks slid off and he ended up getting crushed to death. There's serious danger out there all the time, isn't there?
Yeah, I think you have to have respect for nature, but I mean, obviously these stories hit the newspaper because they're unusual, and people find them interesting. But, you know, the reality, how many people die in London every day from, you know, getting hit by a car or, you know, crossing the road and things. So, you know, I don't, these stories shouldn't put people off going out. Get the right training.
I just think it's that great realization of how dangerous it is, because we've become so used to nothing should ever affect us at all. When you do look at nature, every single animal out there is either being trying to eat something or being eaten itself, isn't it, constantly?
It is true.
And we are that part of nature. I was looking at that Financial Times journalist that sounds horrific, who was eaten by the crocodile. Did you hear about that recently?
Yes.
Because you always listen to TV and stuff and they say, no, lions are fine, sharks are fine, everything's fine. And I always look at it and think, no, they're not. They're predators. They want to eat us. And you know, everyone goes, no, they're more scared of you. No, they're not. Sharks, if you're in the water, don't go and pet a shark because it is going to give you a little nibble. Tell us about the time that you nearly got eaten by lions. I never thought I'd say that in an interview. It is is brilliant. Tell us about the time you nearly got eaten by lions, Megan.
Well, I mean, I come across like big predators in quite a few of the environments that I'm in. This time I was out, I was actually working for a Swiss TV show, and we'd been out there for about 2.5 weeks out of a 3-week show, yeah. And literally dropped into the Namibian desert with nothing. I was looking after one guy who was being filmed. And every night we're going out there and we've got no sleeping bags, got no tents. You're just sleeping on the sand. So you get a fire going, and at night in the desert, it gets pretty chilly. So this one night, we'd done the same as we did every night, made our little camps, little scrapes in the sand, cleared away any stones, built our little fire, and settled down for the night. That night, for some reason, I couldn't get hold of the crew, like the film crew, on the radio. But it was like, I didn't really think too much about it. It wasn't anything I could do about it at that moment anyway. And we went to sleep. And at some point in the night, I just woke up. It's as if somebody jumped out on me. It was that sort of hit of adrenaline, that fight or flight thing. I was like, right, what is this? Like, so I kind of rolled my head to the side. And there was a huge male lion just outside of the firelight, sort of walking backwards and forwards. Just so silent. So it's really fascinating. And I wonder what it was that triggered me to wake up in that way. And so I woke this guy up next to me, and we got some wood back onto the fire, blew it up into flames so it was a bit larger, and spent the rest of the night actually sort of watching this lion. He was joined by two lionesses, and they were there probably, I mean, it felt like hours. I mean, they probably were there for a couple of hours. I mean, it felt like a lot longer than that at the time. Yeah, but you realise how insignificant you are. But going through that situation.
Why didn't they attack you? Because of the fire, you said?
Yeah, I really believe it was because of the fire.
Why are lions scared of fire?
Animals are in general. They have a respect for it. It's, you know, it's something, it destroys their habitats, you know, particularly in dry environments where you might get a strike of lightning that then like decimates like a plain or a forest. So they have this inbuilt respect for it.
You talk a lot about sixth sense, maybe, or intuition. What do you call it? You call it intuition, do you? Or instinct,
intuition. Or the sixth sense, yeah. And I think, I mean, this is something I know that a lot of people say this doesn't exist, but what I see that as it's a change in the environment. You know, I think scientists now say it's like, you know, 95% of your sort of brain function is unconscious. You know, that's only a tiny percent that's actually conscious.
Yeah.
So there's a huge amount of stuff going on. And the reason why so much of the sort of what's going on is unconscious is because it's dealing with all these stimuli coming in from the outside world that would totally overload and burn out your conscious brain if it was aware of it. So sometimes I think signals get sent through to the conscious brain that aren't fully formed. So there's something within the environment that's changed. You know, like in the UK, I know when like a rainstorm's coming because all the leaves kind of change the way that they kind of flip over and they kind of make a different noise. And if you're aware of that, people are aware of that, but you wouldn't necessarily consciously pinpoint that.
And we've stopped becoming aware of our...
Yes, yeah, but there'll be things in everyday life, you know, in the environment that you're used to working, whether it's an office environment or, you know, factory setting, that, you know, things will... You'll use your intuition because there'll be something in that environment that's changed that stops you doing something or tells you to stop doing something. And I think it's really, really important to listen to that little voice.
Yeah, interesting. All through your book, you've got loads of different examples of this, but the one thing that you keep stipulating is listen to yourself.
Yes.
Listen to what you think. And if you think something's wrong, stop and listen to it is the point you say.
I think it's so important. I think that's something that's being lost from everyday life, is that ability to be able to think for yourselves and take ownership. It's like that victim mentality again.
Yeah, and again, most people's normal day life, it doesn't matter whether you listen to it or not, because we're so protected as humans. We've created this society where nothing happens to us. Whereas in nature, why I like your book, is it's not prejudice, is it? Nature will kill you whether you're rich, poor, what race you are. There's no prejudice whether you're a man or a woman. It just will kill you.
Yeah, it really does. It really totally does not discriminate between male, female, coloured. You know, it doesn't matter. You know, and it's all about how you go into it, like mentally. And survival is, you know, initially is about luck. Mm. You know, whether it's a terror attack or whether it's, you know, you're caught in an avalanche. You know, the initial bit is luck as to whether you've actually, you know, survived that situation. But after that, like once you've got yourself into a safe position, then it becomes about, you know, all down on you and self-reliance.
we talked about lions biting your head off or trying to bite your head off, something like that. But also, you've also been bitten by snakes and scorpions as well. You're not bitten by scorpions, are you? You're stung by them. Chance of dying from that must have been pretty high if it was the wrong one.
Yes, yeah, scorpions not so much unless you're allergic to them.
Oh, they're all
them.
Right, are they?
not all of them, no, but...
Is it painful?
It is really painful. Like, being stung by a scorpion is like being stung by like 100 bees at one time.
It was
excruciating, yeah.
And snake as well, you've been bitten by a snake?
Yeah, the snake, I mean, that was my fault in that I was handling it. And in the past, like when I first started working in TV, we did some crazy stuff, and you know, a part of what I was doing was animal wrangling, which, like, thinking back on it now, is like, what the fuck? Like, I really shouldn't have been doing that. And you get quite complacent. And I was handling this snake. It was out in America, and I had it in my hands, and it turned and it just attached itself to my hand. I had in my brain, I actually was able to see it like dislocate its jaw, and I actually thought, wow, that's cool, as it like clamped onto my hand. But I wasn't sure, like, because it looked very similar to a deadly snake, and I wasn't sure which one it was. I wasn't 100% sure of like whether it's a coral snake or a king cobra. Like, I didn't know at the time, so it was a moment of, oh, whoops.
There's this weird thing on TV where TV producers always go, let's get humans to handle dangerous animals. And then it's like, oh, look, they're really scared. Yeah, you're supposed to be scared because you're handling something which should kill you. But I always, because I sometimes have it on my show and they go, hey, you're allowed to pick up the spider. I'm like, I always say to the wranglers or the owners or whatever, do they like being picked up? And they're like, no. I mean, animals don't really want to be touched.
No,
and
they don't.
I think it's this mad thing that we want to hang out with them and touch them and stuff. They don't really want to.
No, they don't. And it's like, you know, these tiny little, like, you know, deadly spiders or deadly snakes. You know, they're not interested in us because we're not prey to them. We're too big for them really to eat. So they're terrified of us, and it's their defense mechanism, and they're employing it. And it's like snakes, actually. It's young snakes that are actually the more dangerous because they can't control their venom. It's the older snakes tend to do like a dummy hit first, like as a warning, because it takes them so. Uses so much energy to actually create venom within like their venom sacs that, you know, they don't want to burn that up. So their initial strike is usually like is a warning strike. And then the second one's usually like the envenomation.
The planet is your plaything. So I imagine you've gone everywhere in the world. We talk about the dangerous animals there. I imagine the thing which is more dangerous though, mosquitoes, malaria and the small things. That's the thing which are more likely to kill you, isn't it?
Yeah. So that and exposure. So exposure to the environment, but definitely bugs and bacteria, protozoa. You know, this is why I always tell people, you know, you shouldn't be drinking straight out of the streams. I mean, even in like the UK, you really should be treating your water first. Yeah, chances are you'd be fine, but you know, you might get nailed by some horrendous bacteria or protozoa that, you know, takes a long, long time to get out of your system.
So what do you do about malaria? Have you done treatments or do you just?
So malaria, I have had malaria and it's really horrible. And at that time, I mean, I wasn't taking anti-malarials because at the time I'd literally been jumping from one jungle to another and they were suggesting that I take different anti-malarials and it didn't work with the drugs. So I always carry with me the drugs to actually be able to treat the malaria should I contract it. Unfortunately, I did contract it at that time and it was pretty horrendous. I've also had Lyme disease as well.
You mentioned that in the book. That's quite a hideous disease, isn't it?
It's horrendous.
We can get that over here.
Yeah, I picked it up in the Lake District. I'd been working up in the Lake District and picked it up. And again, like, it's not about scaremongering and like freaking people out. Yeah. You know, I mean, the chance of getting it are quite slim, but it's just being aware of these things.
Well, the thing is, it's quite easy to heal, isn't it? But it's just, you've got to do it straight away. You didn't bother.
I didn't realize how serious it was, and I was in my late teens, and I was too focused on going climbing than I'd be curled up at the bottom of the crag with like these intense headaches, which I never had, and then the headaches would pass and I'd climb and push myself, and I've just forced it into my central nervous system, and it took a long, long time to come back out again.
What's fascinating about your book is your thought process through everything. You mentioned it earlier, things like hypothermia are going to kill you.
quickly, aren't they? Extreme weathers and getting cold. One of your big things is, you mentioned the book, everyone always says get water, but actually sometimes it's getting heat is or getting warmth from fire is an important thing.
Yeah, I mean, I always get asked, like, what's the most important? Because we always talk about the priorities of survival, like fire, food, shelter and water. And people always ask me which one you should do first. And it totally depends on which environment that you're in. You know, if you find yourself on some super sunny, like, desert island, you know, you're going to want shade, you'll want shelter, and you'll want to find some clean water to drink. But if you're dropped off into the snow, you know, maybe it's finding like an insulated shelter or getting a fire going. Yeah, yeah. It's totally dependent on your situation.
It's so exciting reading your book. And then I got to the bit about you nearly being shot when you're in... you stumbled across an opium field mistake. I'm thinking maybe it's not as much fun. Can you just tell us a bit about that story, because it's quite interesting?
So I was out in actually northern Thailand, again, like, I'd just literally been dropped off into the jungle with nothing. I had a machete and a medical pack to look after the guy that I was with, and we were filming, and just been going through the walking through the jungle, like doing our thing, like doing some survival bits and pieces as we went along. And then suddenly, like, we're going up this really steep sort of escarpment, and suddenly the trees clear, and we're on the edge of this huge, like, opium field. And it took my brain a bit, because I wasn't expecting it. It took my brain just a few seconds to be like, what the hell, what's this? Like, and I should be like, oh shit. And yeah, suddenly, like, thankfully the guys were the other side of this field, and yeah, came running towards us with these rifles. So we're like, we just turned and we just had to run. Yeah,
but you explained it well in the book, because the terror of running and staying quiet, and also the people you're with, trying to get them all. It was the realization that these people are going to kill you, because it's easier than trying to sort of erase your memory or something.
There was a very quick realization that, you know, that we actually did have to run there, because in those situations the opium farmers don't want to be found. Yeah, if the police find them, or if the army go in, and they'll destroy everything there, they'll shoot anybody on site, they burn all the crops. So for us, you know, they don't want anybody else to know that they're there. Our lives were at risk, because, you know, they wouldn't want it getting out that they'd got these opium things, because they're, you know, these are valuable plants. So for us, it was the decision to actually turn and run was the best decision to make. And I mean, we thankfully had had time on our side, because the guys were on the other side of the field, so it would take them a little while to get over to us. So we ran and they were running behind us. That was a terrifying situation. But again, like, in that situation, because I was responsible for the people that I was with, I had a guy who was being filmed, and I had three members of a crew with me as well. And I had to get them out of there and had to get them moving. So again, it's then separating out those emotions, putting them into this box, and dealing with the here and now, and actually getting them out of there.
That's what you're very good at, isn't it? And that's the lesson in the book, is like, it's happening. Get on with it.
Yeah,
it's kind of it's acceptance again, isn't it?
Yeah, and I find, like, I get asked a lot, like, what's the most dangerous situation that you've been in, and I find it really hard. And I actually found, when I was writing my book, I actually found the stories the hardest bit to remember, the hardest bit to put in, because for me, I've dealt with those emotions. Like, I don't remember, you know, the dealing with the opium farmers there, or the lions, or, yeah, I did another job in Mexico where we were hunted by drug cartel. You know, I don't remember those things very well. I don't remember them with any sort of emotion, because I didn't deal with them with emotion at the time.
Interesting, actually, because when you're in a disaster, apparently you have two ways of reacting. One, you feel you're a superhero because you survived it, or you feel you're a victim and you go, you know, you keep reliving it over and over. Apparently, I know nothing about this, but apparently that's what happens. Clearly you enjoy it all. Why do you enjoy it so much, this adventure? Do you know?
Because it's addictive.
Is it?
For me, I suppose I suppose it's like a drug. You know, I find it very, very hard now to be in, coming back into everyday life. I find it, you know, I find it quite mundane. Like I need that, which is probably not very healthy. And I'd love to talk to, like, I'd love to be like analysed by somebody to actually figure out, like, you know, how, why it is that I deal with things in a certain way.
Yeah, I can't reiterate enough. If you're feeling miserable, my friend who's a Marine, one day he's ex-Marine, he's got injured, so he had to get out of it all and everything. But he takes people on treks up mountains and things, and he said to me one day, right, I'm taking you out because you're looking miserable. We went out for a really long walk. It was exhausting. We were getting water from a stream, and he was sticking, because you can get brilliant tools now to they put light into the water,
the UV light.
He's got all the gear and everything like that, and he gave me a kit list, and he said, we're going up Snowdon, and he goes, you need a kit list because the British weather changes all the time. And every year now I notice that people get caught up there because British weather's brilliant as it's changes non-stop. Yeah. But we end up sleeping in a cave for the night up a mountain, and it was just brilliant. I came down a different person. It sounds so stupid, but suddenly to be in nature and do something exciting like that and sleep in a cave, it's just amazing.
Yeah, know? It that totally doesn't sound stupid. I mean, that's a reaction that I see a lot from my clients and from, you know, people that go outside. I think it's that, like, it's confidence building as well. It's self-confidence.
I would take that over a five-star hotel somewhere any day of the week, because it is just amazing. The experience, you just feel, wow, I'm back. It's just being back in nature, back where we're supposed to be, I suppose.
Yeah, definitely. And I think often it's in hindsight, you know, at the time you might be struggling through, you're soaking wet, it's horrendous and like, get me out of here. But actually it's sort of afterwards when you look back and it's like, bloody hell, I just did that.
Yeah.
And it gives you that sense of, confidence in yourself. It's like, yeah, I've just...
But it's self-worth.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And I think that's and trust in yourself and knowing like what you're capable of. You know, I've just come back from a paragliding trip out in the Pyrenees. And I know that I find it when I'm flying through turbulence, I find that still quite terrifying. But for me, when I come back, when I'm up there, I'm just like, bloody hell, I want to get my feet on the ground. But actually, like, you know, afterwards, it's like, you know, it's making me stronger as a person. Yeah. And I think it's the same, you know, with anything that you deal with in everyday life as well, you know, losing loved ones, you know, going through a divorce, all of these things. Yes, it is awful when you're going through it. But it does make you
That's
stronger.
Why I said to you, and I keep saying to you, I wish I'd read your book 10 years ago, because the simplification of accept it is just brilliant. Otherwise, nature will kill you. Just accept your situation and get on with it. And you know, I've been miserable a bit over the last 10 years, and it's a good way of doing it. Now, I got... people laughed at me when I was on Sunday brunch one day because I couldn't move my arm. And the reason why I couldn't move my arm was I was walking along with my... a child who was 3 at the time, I think, and she was becoming a bit of a lump, and she refused to walk. And I thought, right, I'll pick her up, and I had shopping in one hand and her in the other. And I thought, okay, why, if I was walking out of a desert, could I do this to get back to the car? I'm going to walk her out. I was in absolute pure agony as my arm was aching and I was doing that. And I was having this fantasy that I was walking out of a desert with my daughter trying to survive. Everyone laughed at the idea of that. But when reading through your book, I also do this thing where I go with my kids and say, hey, look, let's pretend the zombies have come. There's a zombie apocalypse. What are we going to do? And they go, Dad, really? I go, come on, first we're going to get up one of these trees, right, so we can observe and see. And they're like, look at me like I'm nuts. You do that stuff all the time, don't you?
Yeah, totally. I call it like scenario planning.
But you're planning zombie apocalypse?
Yeah. But it's
why not?
No, exactly. But it's like, it's all like partly, I mean, it's all about actually like, I mean, it sounds a bit cheesy, but it's all about becoming the hero of your own life. You know, it's... how do you prepare for these like crazy scenarios, you know, for the unexpected? And the only way that you can do that, rather than actually being, you know, being putting yourself into those situations, is to trick your brain into thinking that it's been through it all before. And that's what I do on expeditions. I mean, particularly on longer ones where, you know, I'm out there for weeks on end and it's like, I need to keep my brain active. It's like, I'll play these scenarios. So it might be as simple as, you know, walking along and, you know, my client falls off the edge of the path. It's like, how would I get them back up? What if they've got a broken leg? How do I then get them back onto the path? You know, we're 24 hours from help. How am I going to deal with this? down to like the crazy like alien invasions or zombie apocalypses. But it, you know, it keeps my brain active.
But you sit with your boyfriend working out how to survive things, don't you?
Yeah, we do. It's like, you know, going through airports and things. We shouldn't say those things, but going through airports, it's like, you know, what have I actually got on me now? Like, you know, I haven't been able to take my lighter through. Yeah, I haven't been able to take my knife. You know, what have I got on me right now that I could actually, like, you know, make a fire, or I could survive, or, you know, I could defend myself. And those things are like, that's really cool. Like, when you actually start seeing things as not just like, you know, like a water bottle isn't just a water bottle. You know, it's got so many other things that you could use it for as well. And actually, that's a really good thing to play with younger children as well.
Yeah.
Like, either take them into nature, or, you know, put an item in front of them, because their boundaries aren't as sort of structured as ours.
Yeah.
Like, the world's still quite fluid to them, and you learn so much from them.
What is your relationship like with food? Is it because do you just have a relationship where food is fuel for you, or do you actually enjoy it?
Yeah, so I've never had, like, food's always just been fuel for me.
Right.
Like, I mean, I'd be lying if I didn't enjoy the occasional, like, trip to, like, going out for a restaurant and things, but it's never really been, like, important for me. I'm not a great chef. Like, I love cooking over the fire, but at home I'm kind of one pot wonder.
What about food in the wild? Obviously, you'd eat anything that will keep you, give you calories to keep you going, but it's obviously quite dangerous, isn't it, eating? And
it is, I totally would not go
you.
I wouldn't go around just randomly, like, eating mushrooms or berries or, well, anything really, unless you know exactly what it is, because some of that, particularly if you're a long way from help, you know, that stuff can kill you.
And there's a brilliant book in your book, a brilliant bit in your book, where you talk about the Mayans and the Aztecs, and they were the people who tested food were martyrs when they died.
Yeah, so they had people in their, like, societies that would actually, you know, test things for food or for medicinal properties as well, and they were considered martyrs if they died for the greater cause. But, you know, if you think about those rule of threes that you mentioned that's at the beginning of my book, it's like your body can go for around 3 weeks without food. I mean, that's the extreme end. You're not going to be in a good state if you haven't eaten for 3 weeks, but that's quite a long period of time. You know, rescue might come in 24 hours, 48 hours. You don't necessarily need to be eating, like, random berries and things.
Let's talk about responsibility. I said at the beginning it was about accepting and about responsibility. This is another thing that we struggle with. I think everybody does, my kids do. It's taking ownership of your decisions, isn't it, really? And taking ownership of where you are and what you've got yourself into. Obviously, it's different in our lives to being out in a jungle or a mountain. Can you explain what you mean by it in your book?
So I think, again, this is partly to do with, like, the victim mentality as well. But it's like taking ownership of decisions. I think in everyday life now, our lives are quite structured. You know, we have certain things that society says that we need to achieve, you know, like family, good job, finances, you know, even material possessions, house, car, all of these things. And those are the things that, you know, that we're kind of working towards without really questioning. You know, and those things are actually quite fragile. When you look at, like, after a natural disaster, or, you know, war or whatever it might be, you know, those things are lost very, very quickly. So I think, you know, every part of our lives we should take ownership over and take responsibility and, well, own them, own everything that we do, because I think we'll be much happier as well if you know that, yeah, everything in life is because you've worked for it and, you know, you own those decisions.
I think it's getting harder to be responsible for your life because as humans, as our society, we've created so many laws and rules. So someone's telling you what to do a lot of the time anyway. You're not just acting for yourself. You know, we've got all sorts of laws, and then we've got our governments, we've got things. So we're losing responsibility a lot. And I think getting back to actually taking responsibility for your own life and getting away from what society tells you to do, that doesn't mean become a criminal, by the way. that means just thinking about everything for what you want to do and what you want to achieve without going with what the mass thinks. I think is a good way of thinking. I think especially with the materialistic world we live in at the moment.
I think so. I think it's questioning everything as well, because there's a reason why Sort of if you think about like sort of prepperism and preparing for, you know, apocalyptic situations and things, you know, with the state of the world at the moment, like with the politics and, yeah, and things, you know, who knows what's going to happen over the next few years. And I think we need to question everything. Just because somebody says this is the way it is doesn't mean that it is.
I get in trouble for that a lot though, and I bore Mark with it nonstop when he comes up. I've got another theory, Mark. So he just rolls his eyes at me. Interesting, you said something a little bit earlier, because I talk about this on the podcast as well, be the lead character in a movie. You talk about that in your book, you've just mentioned it now. I say this on the podcast, I've been saying it for a long time to people who write in and say, I've got a problem, you know, something to do with my ex or something, and I'm like, take them out of the movie and make yourself the lead character again. I think that's important.
Yeah, that's an amazing bit of advice. And it is important because, yeah, I don't think you can move on. I don't think you can live your life if, you know, like you say, if somebody else is the lead character, you know, it has to be you. And it's, you know, it's easier said than done. You know, it's really hard, like particularly, you know, if you're subject to domestic abuse and things, you know, long term, you know, you lose your sense of self. And I think that's where it comes down to. It's actually building up, you know, who you are.
Yeah.
And I don't think there's a huge amount of room for that creativity in everyday life now, for young people to actually discover who they are and what they want to be.
Let's talk about you being a woman. You're a great female role model. I've said to you, I can't remember I mentioned it earlier on in this podcast, but I want my children to read your book because I think it's a really important book. You are in a male-dominated industry, I imagine.
Yes, yeah, I always have been. But I think, I mean, for me, it's never really been about my gender. When I was growing up, I just had this inherent need to push boundaries and just do my own thing and explore. So I've always been out, and it's usually just myself with a load of guys, like it's never really registered until more recently when people keep saying to me, oh wow, you're the only woman, or you know, that must be really tough. Like it hasn't, I just get on with it because that's what drives me. Yeah, I find it tough, like when I'm working in, you know, cultures where women aren't equal, and you know, when I started, you know, leading expeditions to countries like that, I found it really hard because my ego would get in the way because I want to be listened to and I want people to do what I ask them to do and things. But I very quickly realized that actually I'm in somebody else's culture. I have to respect that and I have to find a way of dealing with that. So maybe using a male client or a male colleague to achieve what I need to achieve. And yeah, it can be frustrating.
How do clients treat it though? They're turning up for a survival trip, an expedition, and they're expecting Bear Grylls, some fella, and then you're there. How do they react to you?
I mean, sometimes have you know, guys trying to push boundaries. Yeah, I used to teach off-road driving, and that I think, like, particularly was,
oh, men love to think they can drive, don't they? Oh god.
And they really can't. Yeah, and it's like, it's so often, like,
oh, that'd be brilliant. I'd love to watch that.
Like, particularly on, like, you know, those corporate do's or like, you know, some stag party where you've got these guys behind, like, you know, the like a really powerful like four-wheel drive vehicle, like, yeah, and you're actually taking them over really technical terrain, and initially in those situations, like initially it'd be like, oh, what do you know, like we're just gonna put our foot down and go really really fast. So I'd like, the first challenge I would take them to was this like really awkward one. It's all about like control and being able to control the vehicle, and like inevitably they'd put their foot down and hammer it and they'd get stuck. And then it would just be, you know, I'd let them rev and let them rock backwards and forwards in this vehicle for a bit. And then at some point I'd just be like, right, well, this is what you need to do.
That would be brilliant.
That was my like, fuck you. Like,
yeah. What's the difference between, your boyfriend does the same job. What is the difference the way you're both treated then? Is there any competition between the two of you? And what is the difference between being a man in the industry and a woman in the industry?
I suppose like within the outdoor industry, it's a bit different. Within the film industry, because I don't know of any other women that do the role that I do, it is expected that it's going to be male and often ex-military. And there's a certain way that, you know, that these guys look and things. So initially it was quite hard, I think, for me to get that recognition, and like, people would defer to him rather than talking to me. But I think more recently, because, you know, I've been in the industry quite a long time now and it's quite a small world and people know me and how I work. We do work in different ways. You know, when we're leading an expedition together or, you know, working on a job, he's much more direct in his way of leadership style, in terms of like, this is how it is, this is going to be how it is done. Whereas I'm much more sort of, I lead with a much more sort of emotional way. I tend to reach people like on an emotional level, mm-hmm. because I feel that people are going to achieve a lot more if they're part of the decision-making process, and if they're part of, you know, that they'll take ownership over getting to the summit, and then it's all about using their emotions to get them there.
Yeah.
And yeah, so that's kind of my leadership style, unless, you know, I have to shout at people, which I do occasionally.
Well, you'd be, if you read the book, you become quite a good people person, as in judging them, haven't you?
Yes.
You're quite good at working out what's happening with people as soon as you meet them.
Yeah.
Out how they can survive.
Yeah, I have to. Yeah. And I think also particularly being a woman as well, you know, it's another way around that, you know, from the very first moment I meet somebody, if it's an airport or, you know, wherever it might be, is that I'm assessing like how they move. Like, are they going to be an issue in terms of fitness, in terms of coordination? You know, you can tell very much from what somebody's wearing when they turn up to do an expedition.
Oh, okay. Like, what do you think about Mark and myself? How would we be on a survival trip, do you think?
Well, I think
that pause is far too long. I'm not happy with that at all. No, that is not good, is it, Mark?
No, I think, I mean, it's the movement and things.
Okay.
It's like how
Mark,
coordinated.
So,
yeah.
All right, I've got an interesting question for you, right? Reading the book, you seem to have utmost respect for tribes.
Yeah.
And you also say that a lot of women are, a lot of females are equipped for bushcraft because the guys were just going out hunting and the women were actually doing all the business, learning how to do it, well, doing stuff. Is that correct?
Yeah, on the whole in tribes, yeah, women tend to do lots and lots of different, like, I suppose, smaller tasks, whereas the men would have like either be to defend or to hunt.
Right, so the point you're making in the book is it's not necessarily men who are going to be the best survivalist, women that either could do it. In those tribes, though, they seem to have very gender-defined roles. They're still quite sexist. There's not a lot of equality going on, Megan, in tribes. What do you think about that? Because we're obviously moving a million miles away from that.
Yeah, I think within those tribes, like, women still have a very powerful role.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think, yes, we are changing, but... You know, and I think this is why it's so fascinating, like, at the moment. And I think that women now have such an interesting role,
yeah.
Because, you know, I always get asked about sort of, you know, feminism and that sort of thing. And actually, like, you know, for us now, I think all women at the moment are like a trailblazing in their own way, because it hasn't been that long since the suffragettes and, you know, equality came about. You know, women now want independence, like, financially, you know, socially, you know, they want to have careers. They want to have, you know, we want to have what men have, but at the same time, you know, we're still stuck with wanting the same sort of those traditional values of, you know, maybe marriage, of, you know, having a family. And they haven't quite, I don't feel they've quite meshed together.
Oh yeah, no, well, I did a documentary on that. It's 100% true. However, because I'm really into equality, really think it's important. I've got three daughters. You know, as I say, I think you're amazing for what you're doing. But it's the tribe bit really got to me, because I thought they've got a very interesting, they're very close to nature. We're not.
Yeah.
And yet they're keeping gender-defined roles. So it confused me. I was going, ah, that kind of doesn't go with what my belief process is.
No, but it is interesting, actually. There's been quite a lot of movement now within sort of people outside of tribes coming in and actually giving money to women and having the women control it from the inside out a bit more. So I was just working out in Kenya, and one of the local tribes there, like, the women were coming into this place to make their beads, sort of their beaded jewelry, and they were getting a wage for it, but only half of it was going to their husbands. The husbands weren't aware of the fact that the women were actually retaining the other half of it.
Right.
And that was then to invest into the village, invest into more beads to be able to make more money. So the women were actually taking control in a different way.
I was out in Zambia, and I saw a lot of stuff. It was out there for doing some charity stuff. And I saw a lot of initiatives with charity. And my favorite one was this woman who had started an orphanage. And there was not really that much security, but she'd managed to get the security of that place locked down, the respect in where we were, which wasn't the greatest area, and a lot of the kids have been orphaned because people were dying of HIV. And I was just like, you need to empower people like her. This is the important thing, because she's actually taking responsibility, and that's where the money should be going.
Yeah. It's so fascinating with all of that. But yeah, I mean, you can't change like thousands of years of development overnight.
Yeah, talking about being a woman though, you're about to go on a solo trip to Alaska.
Yes. Yeah.
And you've had to actually contemplate the idea that you might have to kill another human.
You're laughing
at that, Megan.
I think, you know, those things, yeah, I've, like, you know, with the jobs I do and things, I've seen more firearms on the streets. You know, I've been in situations, you know, where it's been other people that have put my life in danger. And it's, we're so removed from
I don't want to give away all the books. I'm not going to, because you've got to read it. But there was one situation that you felt, if these people weren't getting paid at the end of the day, to collecting their money,
I wouldn't have come back.
You wouldn't have come back.
Read the book
for that story, because it's good. So as a woman, you get yourself put in that situation sometimes.
Yes. Yeah.
But you're solo Alaska and you've got to kill humans. Continue.
I mean, it's like going off into the wilderness areas like that and looking at, you know, wherever it might be in the world, if you're going off into remote areas and you're meeting other people, you know, there's a reason why that those other people might be out there on their own. And, you know, that's a real risk. You know, we're taught in our society in everyday life that we need to be polite to other people and respect other people and be very politically correct. Which I totally agree on in the society that we live in. But if you step outside of that society, that's where, you know, our Western values don't mean so much. And, you know, life doesn't mean as much. And actually, you know, you need to be aware of that. You know, if you're going to be traveling in these other cultures, you know, that your life is not valued in the same way that it is at home. And what are you going to do about it if it comes to, like, push comes to shove?
Yeah. And so you've had to have that. You talked about preparation earlier. And scenarios. So you've actually had to sit there, get that in your head, work it out. So if it actually happens, you're prepared.
Yeah, it's something that I do think about. And, you know, I regularly do things like firearms training, not so that I can pick up that I would actively carry a firearm, but so that if I come across, you know, I'm in a situation where, you know, I need to disarm one or, you know, defend myself, that I can.
You're going to have to do it because the risk is real. And I was thinking about it, and I was thinking, is that risk real? And then I pick up a paper, and it's really, I mean, it's very serious and sad news that solo kayaker, Emma Kelty, she got murdered in the Amazon recently, didn't she? Did you read about that?
I haven't read that one, no.
Oh, so she was in the Amazon. She was kayaking. Right. And some local people apparently said, look, it's quite dangerous where you're going, but she was running out of time.
Yeah.
And so she went she got robbed and murdered. And that's so horrendous. She was doing it on her own. So the risks are real, aren't they?
I think so. And I think, like, social media has a lot to answer for as well. And I think we need to be very, very careful as this sort of, like, adventurer thing rises, which is a brilliant thing because it's encouraging people to get outside. But, you know, those perfect Instagram photos and, you know, things that you see on Facebook, you know, there's a story behind them. You know, the people that are putting up those pictures are only giving you, like, a tiny little snapshot of, you know, the preparation that goes into the expedition and, you know, the training and, you know, the experience that person has. And actually, you know, traveling to these environments, yes, you see it on TV and it looks all glamorized, but the reality of it is these are very harsh places that you're traveling, and to be aware of the fact, like I said, that human life is not valued in the same way and you are a target.
What do you think of politics then? I don't want to go into your political views over here, but what do you think of, you know, global politics, the world? You must have a different view on it to the rest of us, because you're out in these countries seeing different things.
I've definitely, like, while I've been traveling, I've definitely been feeling a lot more unrest. It's just like it's sort of feeling that I pick up. It's like this kind of thing bubbling under the surface, which really worries me. And I've seen, like I said, I've seen more firearms on the streets. I've seen a lot more sort of unrest, and that worries me. And I think we live in a little bubble over here. That's my concern with this sort of losing that sort of ability to be, you know, to assess risk and to take ownership of our own decisions, because there are other cultures out there which are getting quite powerful that don't live in the same way. You know, they're not bubble wrapped. You know, it is about survival of the fittest.
We've moved ourselves, as I keep saying, away from nature. That fight or flight thing, we've actually completely got rid of that. Are we not preparing ourselves for the world, do you think?
Well, I don't think we're allowed to. I think we're kept within these little bubbles and things. I know recently there was actually that, you know, those things with, like, you know, the knives. You now can't buy knives online. Yeah. You know, and which is so jeopardizing, like, the careers of bladesmiths, which is like a, you know, a really ancient art. And, you know, people who are buying like hundreds of pounds worth of like handmade knife are not the people who are going to be going into schools and stabbing people. And I just think, you know, those things, it's like actually removing people's ability to be able to make decisions and to, you know, have take responsibility in buying knives and things is, it just seems, well, to me, it doesn't make any sense.
What I mean, though, is as a culture, Britain, are we, as all our leaders and everything, are we getting ourselves quite far removed away from what other cultures in the world are actually thinking and doing? As you say, they've got a completely different set of values to us sometimes. Are we not aware of what's happening, do you think?
I think so. On the whole, I mean, yeah, if you travel a lot, then yes, you are going to be aware of that. But the majority of people don't travel. You know, they don't have that opportunity.
Do you sometimes sit at dinner parties and go, God, this lot just don't know what's going on?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, I do. And yeah, it's not about scaremongering, but I think it's taking, you know, it's taking ownership of decisions, questioning everything in the world around you and not taking anything for granted, because it can be taken away from you so quickly.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. Apparently there were 9 different sorts of human beings at one stage on this planet, and we're the ones who survived, according to someone I was talking to the other day. What happened to the other 8? So, you know, it all could be taken away from us. I could just interview you for forever, but we can't carry on forever. You have to read the book. We've got 5 questions that I've moved it to 5 now, Mark. I'm going to 5 questions now we ask everybody. And so I'm going to start with the first one. What advice were you given that has been invaluable to your life?
I think one of the key bits that I was given from my first boss actually was that he can teach me the skills, but he can't teach your personality. And that's kind of stuck with me. So yeah, anybody can learn skills, but you can't teach somebody your personality. So, you know, think about the ways that you interact with other people and what you want out of life.
How often are you scared?
Well, when I'm at work, probably on a daily basis.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah,
and you just deal with it, though.
Yeah,
that's
deal with it. Yeah.
And you get excited about dealing with it. That's one of the things you like.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like maybe it's a control thing.
But that's your achievement, isn't it? Something's happened to me, but I controlled it, and that's it was fine. And that's comes across in the book a lot, that you can actually analyze.
Well, you have to control it. I mean, I actually honestly find it harder within an urban environment to be able to control fear and things, because it's not my environment, and there's so many stimuli. It's like traveling on the tube. It's like so much stimulation all the time. And it's like constantly assessing people's body language and things. It's exhausting.
Yeah. You're like maybe like a Buddhist monk or something, though, the way that you are dealing with your emotions. It's a bit like, it is, though, isn't it? Because when something's happening, you quickly go, right, it's happened. That's what mindfulness is constantly, is telling people to look at what they're thinking.
Yeah, and I think you have to. And I mean, in those situations, I don't have a choice. You know, it automatically goes into that. You know, I have to deal with
again,
what I
again, why
with
your
now.
Book is so brilliant. I don't have a choice because I could die, whereas in our world we don't. That's why I thought the book was so good. Right, what one piece of advice would you give our listeners that can help them?
Again, become the hero of your own life. You know, question everything, and you know, trust yourself. Go out into nature, do things that challenge yourself, step outside of your comfort zone, and learn to listen to you know what drives you inside.
One of the bits I quite liked where you say stop, sit down and think.
Yes, yeah, and that stop, sit down and think is like, is really important. Yeah, I teach it when I'm teaching people to navigate. You know, if you've got lost, like the initial reaction to being lost is to run around in panic, which gets you into even worse of a situation. So, you know, just stop, you know, make a cup of tea and like listen and reassess, and then go back into it, and you go back into it a lot calmer with like a much more ability to have like a big picture overview rather than the sort of micromanaging, you know, you're running around like a crazy headless chicken.
Yeah, I've got a new question. So you don't know this one, so you might not have an answer for it because it's quite a weird one. But my friend Pete said, hey, ask your people this question. It's taken off Adam Bilsch's show. It's a podcast which is dissecting high performance in tennis. I'm not sure whether that's got a wide listenership, but thank you, Adam. Blitcher. I'm stealing your question. What's something you believe that others think is crazy? Do you? It's a tough question. I wish I'd prepped you for it, but.
What do I believe?
Is there anything you believe in that others think is crazy?
Well, I think I believe, like, to some extent in like the prepperism side of things, in terms of which I know a lot of people think is a crazy movement, in kind of like preparing for the future. And it's like I'm looking at it in like, you know, preparing in terms of like, you know, stockpiling food maybe or fuel, but also like preparing your mind as well. And I think that's what prepperism really is all about.
Right. Okay. What's a mistake people make? Maybe even doing your job, but what's a mistake people make?
Trying to run before they, you know, they can walk. Actually have got this, before they can walk and they've actually got the skills. People are so keen, like often, you know, particularly within the TV industry, for the glory.
Yeah.
But actually there's a huge responsibility behind it. So, you know, get a really strong foundation. Doesn't matter what you're doing in life, whether it's the outdoors or, you know, becoming a lawyer or a doctor, get a really strong foundation before you start reaching higher.
And finally, any life hacks?
I've got loads.
Here's how to start a fire with just using wood. Go on.
One of the things I got taught really early on was actually always zip up the compartments on your rucksack. Whenever you stop to get anything out of it, always zip those compartments up because it'll stop like any like spin drift in the snow or sand or bugs getting inside.
Ridiculously, this marine taught me how to pack and you didn't think about how to pack, but he also made everything watertight. And he said, just in case there's a leak. So everything that was that week, because we had to have a dry set of clothes and all that thing that's in your book. And I used to think, I was thinking, I was going way over the top here. But reading your book, it's so important. Even how you get across a river is amazing, how you keep things dry and everything else. And I can't recommend your book enough. And we haven't done it justice on this. We've given it a good hour or so. But I really recommend reading it. It's Megan Hine, Mind of a Survivor. If people want to follow you, are you on social media?
I am, yes. Yeah, Instagram at Megan Hine.
And Twitter?
At Meg Hine.
At Meg Hine, yep. Okay. And what have you got coming up next? Anything exciting?
So I'm actually back up to North Wales. We're filming in North Wales for the next few days. And then out to the Dolomites for a Chinese shoot.
Brilliant. Well, thank you so much for coming on. And I'm sorry I've been so gushing about your book. It is brilliant. I recommend everyone buy it. And I reckon buy it for people as gifts. It's a very good book. And especially if you've got kids, get it for them because they should learn a bit about survival and also how to accept life and take responsibility for your own life. Thank you so much for coming on, Megan.
Thank you.
As I say, the lesson from that book, Mind of a Survivor, was if you're up a mountain, if you're in a jungle, if you're somewhere like that and you don't accept what you've done, if you've injured yourself or something, you don't accept it, you die. And that you just take that through to normal life. You get a parking ticket, accept it, it's happened. You know, just get on with life, accept situations that you're in. It's still bloody hard to do and it's a battle for me every day. And I'm the same as everybody else. I miss my train or, anything that happens to me, I still get angry. And then I just have to go, right, you're up a mountain. Something's happened. You've got to get out. I do genuinely think like that. And I think it's really helped me in my life. Acceptance is one of the big keys to having a good brain and a healthy brain. Just interesting stuff she said. And I like the fact that she's... I like the fact that when she talks, she makes me feel like I want to go out and explore and go up mountains and go into jungles and things. I really should go and do more of that sort of stuff. Get out in the great outdoors. A bit of nature, Mark.
Absolutely.
This podcast is sponsored by Cooker, spelt Quooker, pronounced Cooker, 100 degree boiling hot water. Thank you very much for sponsoring the podcast to the guys there. 100 degree hot water straight to your kitchen tap. It does hot water, it does cold water, it does pure filtered cold water, and also it does 100 degree hot water. I love it, one of my favorite things in the kitchen.
immediate brew, immediate boiled vegetables, pasta, whatever else you're making. Also, thank you to our friends at Beer 52 who are happy to advertise on us, and we're happy that they do advertise with us because we like the product. What is it, Mark?
Tim?
Yes.
I've asked you this before. Do you want some free beer?
Yeah.
Would you be happy just to pay the postage? $5.95, get a free case of beer, quality craft ale from all around the world, brought to the UK by beer52.com/lovejoy for your free case of ale.
Could I have it without paying the postage and packaging?
No, absolutely not. That's not fair. How's that fair on Beer 52? They've gone all around the world.
Yeah.
Bought the... I mean... This is the exact problem with this world. Everyone wants everything for free.
Yeah.
And it is free. Just all they're asking is $5.95. Yeah. And you can cancel your subscription at any time. This is that you're getting, they're giving everything to you and you're giving nothing back.
Where are the beers from though?
Well, I mean it can be, you know, there's been months have been from the Brexit month. We've had the rugby.
I think we better explain the Brexit month. That was beers from Europe.
Yes. Beers from Europe. Yes, we've had the Six Nations.
From Six Maine. Nations who play rugby. Yeah,
yeah. We've had from the state of Maine in the US. So you know, it can be from anywhere.
Yeah, we've had the Korea one.
Oh yes.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
That's good. We still haven't had any from. We have not had any Skull.
No, yet, we haven't. Or the other one you looked up a few
but
weeks ago.
I like the idea. So I get, how many cans do I get?
So you get eight cans or bottles plus a snack and the Ferment magazine, which we once featured in.
Yeah,
which was very cool.
And they're all different, aren't they?
It's
a subscription service. So every month they're different. Yeah.
Yeah, and you can cancel the subscription at any time. Yeah. And if you like a particular beer in that pack, you can go to the website and go to the, they'll give you a link to order more beer, that specific beer.
But is there any way I can get it for free without paying the postage?
No, Tim, and I think you're slightly undermining the message here, which I'm going to get quite across with you when I press stop record later. So there you go. I think that's a fair deal.
It is a good deal because you get free
beer. It's people like you that have ruined this country.
Yeah.
I do like it.
I like the idea of free beer. Yeah. I would just prefer it if I didn't have to pay for the packaging. It was just, everything was free. That's what I prefer. But you know, it's fine. If I've got to pay that, then I'll pay that.
You've shat all over that.
That's it. That's Beer 52, BEER 52 is the number /
Lovejoy. Which is your surname. How can you forget that?
My name, yeah. That's it for this week's podcast. We'll be back very soon with another one. Please contact us at Tim Lovejoy or DearLovejoyPodcast@gmail.com. We will see you all very soon. For time being, peace and Lovejoy.
Bye.